You're listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast from the Modern War Institute at West Point. I'm John Spencer, Chair of Urban Warfare Studies at MWI and host of this podcast. Today's guest on the podcast is Professor Lori Blank. Professor Blank is a clinical professor of law and director of the International Humanitarian Law Clinic at Emory University School of Law. From 2022 to 2024, she was the special counsel to the general counsel at the Department of Defense. Her most recent book is International Conflict and Security Law, and she is the co-author of International Law and Armed Conflict, Fundamental Principles and Contemporary Challenges in the Law of War, a casebook on the law of war. Lori, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. Good to be back.
Okay. So in the last episode, we covered legitimacy, one of the principles of joint operations, or as you and I agreed, principles of war, its importance, as well as the need for all stakeholders to understand the differences between the laws of war, rules of engagement, and civilian harm mitigation measures, as well as how factors of context can impact rules of engagement and civilian harm mitigation. I highly recommend listeners go back and listen to that episode if they haven't yet. In this episode, though, I want to focus on civilian evacuations, getting civilians out of harm's way, especially in urban warfare where there are lots of civilians present. And I want to see if we can take on the element of what's called siege warfare. So can we start with a somewhat loaded question, but I hope it opens the conversation that I hope we're going to have. Is it a legal requirement to evacuate civilians before attacking an enemy force in an urban area like a major city?
So, this, I guess, is whatever, the $64 million question. Anytime we're talking about urban warfare, we're inherently thinking about a lot of civilian harm and a lot of civilian suffering, and therefore need to be thinking about all the possible ways to mitigate and minimize, and where possible, avoid that harm. That's a moral, that's basic humanity. And of course, one of the core purposes of the law of war is to protect civilians and others who are not in the fight from the hazards of war, right? So we're kind of thinking about the hazards of war on steroids anytime we're in a major urban warfare context. So one of the things I think that's really important to think about when we talk about evacuations and we talk about siege, which we'll get to, I'm sure, later in our conversation, and other urban warfare thorny questions, it sometimes gets lost in the conversation that there are two parties to the conflict, and both of those parties have legal obligations. It's very common, as you know, from all of the work and the conversations that you have, it ends up being really common to always think about what are the obligations of the attacking party? What are the rules that apply to the attacking party? What did they violate? What should they have done better? But we have to remember there's another party to the conflict, and they also have obligations. So with that in mind, I kind of want to hit on both of those a little bit in thinking about your question. When we think about the party you asked about, right, as a starting point, right, before attacking an enemy force in an urban area, when we think about evacuation, if I'm assuming from your question that this attacking force is not controlling that area, right, they want to control that urban area, but they don't yet. So they probably don't have the capability physically, right, capacity-wise to actually evacuate. But they may call for evacuations. They may, seek ways to get the civilians out of there. And obviously, it's going to be beneficial generally for that party because it's easier to attack enemy forces if the civilians aren't there. So if we first think about calling for civilians to evacuate, I would fit this within the idea of a warning, of a precaution that an attacking party needs to take when it is planning or launching attacks. And the law of war requires that an attacking party take feasible precautions to minimize harm to civilians. And one of those that's relevant here is providing an effective advance warning of attacks that may affect the civilian population where circumstances permit. And you'll notice that there was the word feasibility, and there's the idea of where circumstances permit. And this is all of a piece with the law of war generally, which is always balancing or finding ways to bring together both the military imperatives and the humanitarian imperatives that are always going to be present during wartime. So that's, you know, what feasible is thinking about, is recognizing that there are a variety of considerations. So, you know, issuing a warning that calls on civilians to evacuate areas where attacks are going to take place, or where they, you know, hostilities or combat operations are anticipated, is one of those precautions. And so the idea is, first of all, that it's where circumstances permit. There may be situations that do not permit providing a warning to the civilian population. If, for example, think about specific attacks, right? If you're attacking an enemy militant, you know, an operative, a fighter for the other side, and you provide a warning, they're obviously going to go somewhere else. So you've essentially defeated the purpose of the attack altogether. So there will be times where surprise or other considerations play a role. In terms of the actual warning itself, it needs to be effective in the sense of reaching the civilian population. Effectiveness is not about whether the civilians actually follow it. So, because you can't control what civilians choose to do, but the idea is to give them a warning, hey, the area where you are is not safe. Go and ideally point them to an area that's more safe. Give them a reasonable amount of time to evacuate from a particular area. And that's sort of the basic idea, because again, if civilians evacuate, that improves the ability to carry out military operations. But let me just, before we sort of move on to the next thing, let me just talk also about the other party to the conflict, which is the one that is defending or, you know, positioned in that urban area. And they're the ones who actually have an ability to actually evacuate civilians as a, you know, in the physical sense. And here we're also talking about an obligation of precautionary measures. And we would call the defending party's obligations, we would call them passive precautions. And here the law says, among other things, that the defending party has an obligation, and I quote, to the maximum extent feasible, to endeavor to remove the civilian population, individual civilians, and civilian objects under their control from the vicinity of military objectives. So the idea is, if you can, you want to move civilians and the civilian population away from military objectives. So all your military facilities and anything that would be a lawful target of attack from the other side. Obviously, feasibility is the framing here as well. It depends on resources available, the risks it poses to your own forces. Perhaps it's only possible to evacuate the sick and the elderly and children. But where it is feasible to evacuate civilians and that party does not do so, it's reasonable to ask questions about human shielding, right? Which I think we'll come back to. So, you know, there's, a variety of considerations in thinking about your question of a legal requirement to evacuate. Certainly, both sides have some obligations there. They might play out differently depending on the circumstances.
Amazing. And actually, I was at NATO conference not too long ago for the Rapid Reaction Corps, and said, you know, NATO is a defensive alliance. It talks about attacking a lot, not so much the defending part, where, like you said, we overfocus sometimes on the attacker. In our war games and scenarios, you're always the attacker. But that defender has obligations as well from, again, you're the expert, but like from even distinguishing in distinction themselves from civilians. Like an example I always give people, because I visited, was Ukraine when I, in the opening months when I went there, if a civilian was partaking in the hostilities, usually they had that yellow or blue tape around their arms, identifying themselves as doing that, partaking in the hostilities. But I want to go back to the attacker because sometimes it is confused. I definitely get feasible precaution and where the circumstances do not permit. But how do, especially at that higher level, do you balance that from the, even when I would teach cadets like Sun Tzu, there's a like a question on the quiz, like what did Sun Tzu say is the most important thing in war? And you could either answer it as surprise or intelligence. And it's depending on how you read the, in what version you read and what translation, it's surprise. When you're attacking, let's say a country, you know, you're doing a Maximus campaign, what we call unlimited campaign to overthrow a power, and in the balance, like we did for the invasion of the United States forces, Panama, Afghanistan, Iraq, how Russia invaded Ukraine illegally, but even the military approach, there wasn't the evacuation. And I'm assuming that there is that question of, okay, how much does the enemy advantage to surprise in achieving the goal? And this is kind of like from the urban warfare lens, also the element of, I understand, of course, the balancing of the two, military and humanitarian, but as kind of an analyst, where if you tell the enemy you're coming and they're in a defensive role, they're going to get more ready. But it also, they could abide by their obligations and then remove the civilians. But the one of the major approaches to basically achieving a military goal in an urban area is to use that surprise, speed, and overwhelming force. Coup de main, coup d'etat, in those joint forcible entry, where you try to use that overwhelming force so there isn't a protracted, which we're going to talk about, I'm sure, in sieges, protracted urban operation block by block. You actually use that speed to achieve that psychological impact, kind of like the Battle of Baghdad.
Yeah, I mean, this is so much of what we're going to talk about. I know the word balance is going to come up in probably, if not every sentence, right? It's going to come up often, because whether it's that big picture balance in the law of war of military necessity and humanitarian imperatives, but, you know, thinking about your question, right? Balancing the value of surprise and speed and everything else you just talked about. What's on the other side of that balance, right? Even when we're thinking about something like, well, clearly I don't want to tell the enemy I'm coming, right? That is pretty basic, right? On the other hand, even when you are operating under those core tenets of surprise and speed and so on, you still have the law of war fundamental rules about precautions and proportionality when you're attacking. So you have to take into account the presence of civilians, even if you are trying to act with surprise, trying to act with speed, with overwhelming force, and so on. So somewhere in there, and that's going to be the commander's judgment, where is the sweet spot in there in kind of getting the drop on the adversary, in essence, with surprise, but also having a battle space in which I can achieve my objectives given the presence of civilians and civilian objects and the civilian population. Somewhere there's a, again, maybe a sweet spot is not exactly the right term, but I think you know what I mean, where if it's a heavily, very densely populated area with lots of civilians, I am going to be constrained appropriately by the law and by my own morality in not wanting to cause harm to those I don't intend to harm. So perhaps there's a middle ground in there where, even though I want to achieve surprise and speed, I also will be able to operate better if the civilians aren't there. And I think we want to remember also that the law of war operates in tandem with military doctrine, right? It's not a competitor to, or a, you know, it's not in contrast with or in opposition to military doctrine. It actually, they work hand in hand together. And I think this is maybe one example where we see that as well.
Absolutely. And this is, as you know, you've been to our course, the 40th ID Urban Operations Planners course, not just for the commanders, his staffs and planning operations, where even if you weren't going to do the warning, it still can factor into the planning. You have to factor in the presence of that civilian population, the density. So this is where you're understanding the city and understanding the military objective and how to achieve that. Like, where are those highly dense portions? Where are the objectives, offsetting objectives, the choice of fires, all of these things that get factored into it? Absolutely. And what a great segue too into the next question, which is, I don't know if we answered that question, but you kind of did which I always get Colonel Lance Blanco, you know, who's the JAG for the 40th ID, says, you know, many times in war, I've gotten questions, and it's the commanders asking, you're not asking, can you, you're asking, should you, which this balance that you're talking about, and like legal, but also other balancing considerations like the humanitarian obligation of precaution. Okay. This one, I think we kind of covered, but I want to make sure that we did. How does the principle of proportionality apply when an evacuation may not be feasible?
Yeah, this is, you know, an important one, because you might hear, hopefully not, but, you know, we want to be attentive to people making an argument that, well, I told, you know, the civilians to evacuate, so anyone who doesn't evacuate, I don't have to worry about them. That's absolutely not the law. The obligation of proportionality is, you know, in the circumstances at the time, not, oh, whoops, I, you know, I offered you the chance to leave before, and once you decide to stay, too bad, right? You're fair game, right? That is not how the law works. So the fact that civilians remain in an area after there are calls for evacuation or other efforts to warn them, or even actual efforts to facilitate their evacuation, the fact that they might remain does not change their status as civilians. It doesn't change their protection from attack. And so proportionality and precautions are going to apply in the same way.
Absolutely. For our book, Understanding Urban Warfare, Jason Giroux, Liam Collins, we actually did from our case studies that we were using, about a 10% of the civilian population, no matter what has ever been tried, still there. Right. And I've never, this is where we tell from military training, if you're conducting military training, whether it's at the division level, down to the company level, and there isn't civilians present, then you're not being realistic, because I can't find an urban battle. And I'm talking where military units will wait months, and if not longer, and do evacuations, and there's still civilian presence there. And we can talk about current operations to historical ones, like the Battle of Aachen in World War II, where both the Germans and the Americans do two evacuations, and there's still thousands of civilians there. There's still the obligation, absolutely.
Yeah, and there could be so many reasons, right, that why people choose not to leave.
Is there any other kind of major issues and considerations just in this general topic that I started with? Any examples? I think when you were lecturing in the course, I caught something about Croatia as an example, talking about evacuations. But is there anything else before we move to kind of the difference between, which I really want to get into, temporary evacuations versus forced evacuations?
Yeah, I think there are considerations, sort of pragmatic ones, which I think we'll end up coming back to. But just, you know, I think it's always useful to put the conversation into sort of sharp relief by thinking about, we think, oh, evacuating civilians. Okay, that's good. They go from scary place to safer place. That's great, right? So yeah, that's a good idea. But there are security issues for civilians, you know, en route in the process of evacuating. They're not necessarily just parading through completely safe areas. There are considerations about whether there would be resources available in the areas to which they are heading or being evacuated to. Are there shelter, you know, is there shelter? Is there food accessible? Is there medical care? Apart from some of these will play into the legal analysis, but also just as pragmatic thinking, I think those need to be in the mind of any military planner who's thinking about this from either side. They're obviously core issues that NGOs and other relief organizations are thinking about. And so, you know, just to keep in mind that moving away from areas of active combat, it always sounds good, but it's also always more complicated.
Absolutely. And hopefully we'll talk about, I mean, it gets down into the tactics of like the green routes and providing the both the route and the area, even tactical pauses to facilitate that, which has happened in modern times and just the ongoing conflicts right now. But okay, I think we'll get to them as we talk through some of the questions, I hope. Now, something that's come up in these conversations that I've found is, how does the law of war, or basically what's if there is a difference, address what we were talking about, which is these warnings and calling for evacuations to get civilians out of harm's way, which versus what somebody might call a forced evacuation?
Yeah, so the law of war prohibits forcible displacement or transfer of the civilian population. That's a, I guess we could say, a starting point. So it prohibits the forcible transfer or deportation of civilians from occupied territory. That's, you know, one core example of how the Geneva Conventions of 1949 are very clearly written in response to World War II, right? We can find that all throughout the Geneva Conventions, but that's one I think we're all familiar with, you know, why that is there. The law also forbids ordering the displacement of the civilian population, but here's an important exception: unless it's for the security of the civilians involved or imperative military reasons. So big picture, right? The law frowns upon, it forbids, and for good reason, forcible displacement. We don't want wars to be fought for the purpose of massive displacement of people, and we don't want wars to be a cover for massive displacement of people. We've seen that in the past. We know that story. But the law also recognizes, as it does in so many other aspects of the law, that there will often be good reasons for, and when I say forcibly, I mean, you know, not just saying to civilians, hey, it'd be better if you go over there, but literally moving them from place to place. And the exception is evacuating them because of imperative military reasons or the security of the civilian population. And so this really reflects the realities of warfare, in which transferring civilians, you know, displacing them, may be necessary both to protect their security and also to preserve the integrity of the military operation. So there is a line, right, between an evacuation, which is a legitimate humanitarian action, literally moving people to another place for their safety or for military reasons, and between that and forcible displacement, which is a violation of the law and in many situations a war crime. So, okay, you might then ask, I'm assuming the next question would be, well, what is that line, right? How do you know the difference? How do you know the difference as the good faith military commander who is trying to figure out, can I do this? Is this beneficial for my operations? Is it appropriate? Also from the perspective of the external observer, the court, the UN, the NGO, the, you know, other governments, any interested observer, right? How do we understand where that line is? So first of all, it's worth just recognizing that there are times when it is in the interests of the civilians to keep them safe to move them, right? To protect them from the dangers of military operations. It is also important to recognize that there will be times that this idea of imperative military necessity also justifies moving civilians. And we have some guidance from the jurisprudence of some of the international criminal tribunals, like the Yugoslavia Tribunal and some others. And so just a couple of examples that people have sort of derived from this jurisprudence that they've pulled out from these cases is for this idea of imperative military necessity, what we can sort of grab from past cases is that there actually has to be an actual military threat, right? This is not a speculative or hypothetical idea of imperative military necessity. There needs to be an actual military threat. This evacuation or displacement of the civilians has to be carried out in a manner that is conducive to their eventual return. So there were cases where the party of the conflict that was displacing civilians also burned all of their homes. That's not really that. So that's pretty clearly not conducive to their eventual return, right? And the courts have generally said it should not be planned in advance, because if it's planned in advance, it's not really a response to an imperative military need that is sort of arising and you have to address. So those are some examples that can, I think, help provide a little bit of direction in that regard. And I think we want to keep in mind sort of those underpinnings of the law of war, which is it does rest on reasonableness and on good faith. So in assessing somebody else's decision, we want to be able to put ourselves in his or her shoes and consider whether this was a reasonable judgment made in good faith. The question is not, is it the judgment I would have made, but is it the judgment that I can see was a reasonable one made at the time?
Well, that's actually very helpful. And especially as the active military threat, as I've tried to envision, but there's so much nuances and why I'm so happy to have you on about, you know, in the midst of a conflict versus, like you said, a pre-planned for the purpose of displacement, like the start of an operation versus, you know, who's attacking, who's defending, what's that reasonableness of threat and statements by both participants in the conflict. There's a lot there, actually. But that makes a lot of sense to me and very helpful. And I hope that the listeners identify those helpfulness, both the keeping civilians safe, what I call, and I'll refine my, I'm always learning. And that's why I loved having the podcast. I learned so much every time. I usually use the term, you know, moving civilians out of harm's way, which safer and completely out of harm's way, which basically for, you know, security, for keeping them safe, and that imperative military necessity, which is to separate the civilians from the actual combatant military. How does this play out for you when it's basically you have a combatant using human shields, and the case I'll give, you know, just like we saw in the Battle of Mosul, when ISIS was trying to force civilians to stay, to be utilized as human shields. Of course, you covered how that's probably not following their obligations under the laws of war, but how does that look into this question of forced and then military imperative?
So, using human shields is absolutely a violation of the law. And I'm going to come back to that in one second. For the other party, right, let's call it the attacking force, the fact that their adversary is using human shields does not absolve them from any of their obligations under the law. It does not erase proportionality. It does not erase precautions. And that's why armed groups and some states engage in this really nefarious practice of using human shields, because they know that it gets at the heart of the adversary's law compliance. And it it is unfortunately, you know, sometimes really nefarious things can also be effective. And so you still have to abide by your obligations to minimize harm to civilians and, you know, take the same steps you would in terms of precautions and proportionality. On the assumption that those civilians are being forced to stay there in some way, right? And that could play out in a variety of ways. They're actually literally in each locality forcibly kept near military objectives, or they are sort of in a larger area, not allowed to leave an area. I think the idea of the attacking force being able to evacuate those civilians is operationally unrealistic, because they probably have to fight their way in to get to those civilians in order to evacuate them. So I'm going to sort of put that option off to the side. But I think what's important to note here is that we would all benefit. The application of the law, the discourse about the law, and those core goals of protecting civilians would benefit greatly if we had more condemnation of human shielding. And the, you know, actually reminding everybody that this is not just distasteful, but unlawful. And the failure to condemn it in either at all or in strong enough terms, and to hold people accountable, really just creates an incentive to keep doing it. And so I think however that needs to be done, that's a piece of the discourse about the law of war that I think we've all fallen short on. And, you know, we see the results of that, because there's far too much of that kind of human shielding and similar activity going on.
Absolutely. And the condemnation seems to be lacking for people that do that. Yeah. Preparing military forces for combat operations, I say, if you want to lessen the occurrence of it, get better at it. So if you don't condemn human shielding, logically, you'll likely see from nefarious actors more use of it. And that's what we've seen just in the last, you know, 10 years, really.
Yep.
So I'm going to shift to really similar, that but an important topic about some international norms. But I wanted to hit, since you mentioned it, but the role of, or what role do humanitarian organizations and non-government organizations play in facilitating civilian evacuations?
So I think they play a really important role. It's going to be different in different conflicts, because what is their access? What is their interaction with the military and governing faction, you know, state, military, and government, or the leaders of armed groups and armed forces? So it's going to play out very differently in different situations, purely on the basis of that. Often we will see NGOs or other humanitarian organizations play a major role in evacuations, in helping to not just provide the resources for civilians at that place to which they have evacuated, but, you know, helping to facilitate the evacuation itself. But your question also gets me thinking about some other questions, not just about the role of those organizations, but also about the interaction between militaries and NGOs in this scenario. Right. So what happens when a military and NGOs work together? Right. What risks does that create for the organizations? Are they seen to be in bed with one side to the conflict? And that can be pose an enormous risk for humanitarian workers. Again, not because they actually are taking sides, but simply because others may perceive them too. So for organizations where impartiality and neutrality are fundamental pillars, they have a lot of hard questions to think about in how they play, you know, carry out their key objectives in helping civilians. How can they do this and also protect themselves and their workers? You know, I think a couple of other questions that come up just in this sort of practicality space that we haven't talked about, and I don't, you know that there are hard and fast answers, but we haven't sort of thought about the question of screening the civilians that are being evacuated to make sure there aren't fighters evacuating along with them and slipping past the opposing forces, right? So if you're evacuating civilians, can you screen? Can you use force to keep enemy fighters from mixing in with them? You know, those are also realistic and hard things that are going to come about and need to be planned for and need processes put in place in advance so that, you know, to try to avoid the challenges that arise when those things have to be figured out on a split second basis.
No, absolutely. And every time we talk, I'm like, well, we have to come back to these things, almost like a whole separate episode on the tactics of civilian evacuations, from, you know, the dropping of flyers, very historical, to flying drones in with speakers. Some of these things would assist in warning and in temporary evacuations. Same with screening. I remember as a soldier in combat, having a book full of faces where I'm looking and trying to identify enemy combatants intermixed between civilians because they didn't wear uniforms, and say, okay, I'm looking for this high value target and I'm looking through everybody's face. Luckily, technology is advancing to where now you see the deployment of facial recognition technology. So where you might have a screening station, civilians trying to get out of harm's way, facial recognition identifying named combatants from the opposing military, and how that works, I absolutely understand. And that's why we also bring in NGOs to our course at the 40th ID. When we did the urban operations course, is that, you know, that impartiality is so critical for them, so they can do their mission usually in a humanitarian lane. There are some recent examples that really come to mind, especially in Ukraine, where you had besieged cities, which we'll talk about, or isolated cities, and you had other groups facilitating both parties identifying a pause to allow civilians to evacuate a corridor, a green corridor, and then actual non-government organizations using buses to assist the civilians who, you know, some were walking out. I remember that very vividly. A big part of that. Okay. I don't want to end without also asking a question that's really coming around a lot as well, is maybe a more of an international norm, but it could also be illegal, I think, because it depends on the country's treaties and all these things, is, are there any international norms for allowing civilians to flee combat zones? And I ask that just from recent operations, which involve a lot of urban areas, such as the Syrian war, where, you know, 6.8 million Syrians fled to countries like Turkey, Germany, Jordan. And then in the initial phases of the Russian invasion of Ukraine in 2022, at the height, you had about 6.8 million Ukrainians flee to neighboring countries such as Poland, Hungary, and Moldova. Is there some international norms of, we talked about the kind of the, not the tactical, but, you know, that major urban site and the precaution and all the obligations, but is there an obligation for other countries to also accept refugees or people fleeing combat areas to try to get them completely out of harm's way?
So, yeah, I mean, here we're getting into international refugee law and asylum law. And that law really was developed for exactly these kinds of circumstances, that people fleeing persecution, fleeing conflict, would be able to get over a border, right, and get to safety. And so in general, you know, a refugee is someone who's been forced to flee his or her country because of persecution, war, or violence. And then countries have obligations, if they're parties to the International Refugee Convention, to treat such persons appropriately. So again, it's going to depend on a country's, what treaties they're a party to, but that is in essence the whole idea of a refugee, right? Is that somebody can find shelter in essence, right? From the persecution or war that they're fleeing from, and not be left sort of stateless and literally, you know, stuck between borders, right? Unable to go back because of the danger, and unable to cross because nobody will let them in, which of course, again, responds to, you know, events earlier in the 20th century.
Right. Yeah, I think that's important for listeners. And I won't, you know, we could talk all the different specific cases of, but really looking at what, if a country is refusing something, looking at, okay, why are you refusing? Are they a signatory to the International Refugee Convention or other treaties and conventions relating to that topic? Great. Lori, I really wanted to get to siege warfare. So I want to ask the question because I get it all the time. But I want to start off with my definitions because I have some very, I think words matter, and sometimes stuff does get lost. And I don't think you're using that word the same way I am. So I want to switch topics really quickly. We'll probably have to do another episode because it does start to broaden, but siege warfare. I think people use it, the word siege, liberally or more than I would. To me, and I'll give my definition. When we first started the Modern War Institute, we wrote an article about, because we were actually looking at the siege of Sarajevo, and one of our contemporary battlefield assessments was to go there, and it wasn't in joint doctrine, the word siege. And then we had to ask, okay, why is the word siege not in there? And I think we'll get there. To me, since it's not doctrinally defined, I'll define it. A siege is a military operation in which a defending force is surrounded, isolated, and subjected to sustained attacks, typically with the goal of forcing the surrender through attrition, blockade, and direct assault. Sieges often involve cutting off supplies, bombarding positions, and using starvation, psychological pressure to break the defender's resistance. The key for me in the siege is that it's being deployed as a form of warfare, as in it's the primary form of warfare to achieve the political objective. In the case of this, would be for the defenders to surrender. Now, I distinguish that from what I call a military encirclement or an isolation, which is a precondition to many forms of attacks, and specifically city attacks, such as a deliberate attack, which doctrinally for U.S. joint doctrine requires isolating of the enemy in the urban area, even defined as success in defeating enemy forces in large urban areas, typically require the ability to isolate them from physical information and human support. That's actually straight out of doctrine. Now, the new urban doctrine kind of says that's nearly impossible, so you have to be very specific to the urban area because of the scale of urban areas in a modern world. The key, though, for me, in difference to a siege, is that an encirclement and an isolation, or cutting the enemy from supplies, reinforcement, support, is in preparation of the attack and not the method being deployed. Now, I don't know if you share that same distinction, but I've heard a lot, and I personally don't agree, that the age of siege warfare is back, because we do see a lot more urban battles in the last 20 years, which do involve basically a city, and then you have an encirclement. A lot of times you don't. You have an isolation of like key routes, and you can do that with fires and all these things. But I personally don't believe so, because I understand the distinction doctrinally between a method of warfare. Like, what are you doing, and what is the goal of what you're doing, is in preparation of all these other factors, especially at the operational level down to the tactical level. But the question I wanted to ask you, because I think it's really important, and I get it all the time, is, are sieges legal under the laws of war? What are the applicable laws or evolutions in the law, and how a modern interpretation of siege warfare align with international law, particularly under the Geneva Conventions and any additional protocols.
Yeah, so I agree with you that it is a method of warfare. It's obviously been used for centuries to, you know, like you said, pressure a defended area to surrender. And the whole idea, I think, at a basic level of a siege is you do that instead of going into the city and fighting building by building, block by block. And on many levels, it's actually going to offer greater opportunity to spare civilian life in comparison to an all-out assault on an urban area. So, right, I agree with your differentiation. As far as the law, it is permitted. Siege is not defined, doesn't have a legal definition per se, which I think just reinforces what you're saying, right? It is a method of warfare. There's doctrinal definitions. It is not prohibited by the law, as long as the purpose is to achieve a military objective and it's not imposed with the purpose of starving the civilian population. And so in that sense, think about almost any military operation, any method of warfare in the same way, right? That if it's done intentionally to harm the civilian population, it's not going to be allowed. We see in the law recognition of the use of siege as a military tactic. We see it in the 1907 Hague Convention and in the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. And basically what we see in the law is not, you know, thou shalt be allowed to besiege, right? We don't sort of see pronouncements like that, but we see rules or requirements when engaging in a siege. So for example, the Hague Convention talks about parties seeking to reach agreements to evacuate certain classes of vulnerable civilians from besieged areas and allowing free passage of religious and medical personnel and equipment, sparing religious and cultural property in besieged areas. So again, I think the law allows for siege. It does not provide a whole lot of guidance, but it certainly does, I think it recognizes it, it permits it. The question is, what are the limits, the guidelines, the parameters? And so there, you know, the next question is, well, the whole, you know, what happens in a siege is people go hungry, right? And so we then come to the prohibition in the law of war of starvation as a method of warfare. And so the law prohibits intentional starvation of the civilian population. And for many people, I think that leads them to argue that a siege inherently is unlawful because it seeks to deprive the besieged area of supplies and contact with the outside world, again, in an effort to induce surrender. But that's not how the law works. A siege is not prohibited, as long, again, as the purpose is to achieve a military objective and not to starve the civilian population. If you besiege an area for the purpose of starving the civilian population, it's going to be prohibited. So in terms of the, you know, the goal, why are you besieging? That's where we're going to draw the line.
Okay, so I'm going to ask a tough question because I get this tough question. Yeah, but I'm besieging the enemy and there just happens to be civilians there. So I'm just restricting food, water and supplies to the enemy, and there's presence of civilians. So would it be possible to do a siege, even if that was your intent? Because then you breach into the precaution and other things. I believe that you can starve an enemy. You can't starve an enemy's population.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And so here is where, first of all, we see a lot of debates, but also we see really the hard questions and the hard lines that war inherently forces upon us. And so let's stick with a siege that is for the purpose of achieving a military objective, right? Because we know the ones that are done solely for the purpose of starving civilians, those are prohibited. So let's stick with a siege that has a lawful purpose. Now we get to the question that you have, okay, but there are civilians there and they're getting hungry. So what the law also requires is that if the civilian population is inadequately provided with food and other essential supplies, which over time is what's going to happen, then the besieging party must allow the free passage of such supplies in accordance with any technical arrangements that it puts in place, right? So it can require search to make sure that no unallowed items are getting through. It can also stop the free flow of humanitarian supplies if the adversary is diverting them for its own purposes. So now you have to have some information that leads you to that conclusion, but you don't have to allow supplies in that then all go to the enemy's military forces. So you can put in place, again, technical arrangements, procedures, processes to search, to screen out contraband, weapons, etc., and also take into account whether things are being diverted, because that would defeat the whole purpose of your siege in the first place.
Interesting.
Now, that sounds easy, right? But it's incredibly difficult.
Yeah, the diverting part, right? Because if you have an enemy that doesn't follow any obligation, and you have a civilian population that needs resources, but as soon as it goes in, visibly diverted by the enemy.
Exactly.
For their use primarily.
And ultimately, right, again, we're back to that balance between the effectiveness of the siege as a military tactic, because again, let's remember, like, excluding the siege for the purpose of starving civilians, right? We've ruled that out, right? So we're talking about a siege that is being imposed for a military purpose. Well, then we're interested in it being effective. There's no point in doing something if it's not going to be effective and it's not going to work. But we also want to recognize the humanitarian imperative of preventing starvation. And so again, balancing, trying to do two things at the same time, in essence.
So I have a hypothetical, and I hope you don't mind, on this exact case, because I've seen it in recent times, of isolating an enemy, the diverting of supplies, and then basically in conjunction with the evacuations, could you set the supplies outside of the combat area for civilians to move to? Or is that beyond the reasonable considerations of balance between the humanitarian concern and the military objectives? So basically you have a isolated urban area where anything that goes in, the enemy is taking. The civilians are inside of the enemy's territory, but you want to put the supplies outside the enemy territory so that the civilians can move to it, and it is an attempt to keep it out of the enemy's hands.
So I think the immediate question that I would have, because it's a great question, and it seems to be a very reasonable way to address the challenge, right, that sort of lies at the heart of the hypothetical. And as you've said, it's not actually hypothetical, right? We see this happen all the time. Is, are civilians able to leave the area? So if the adversary, right, the defending party in this siege scenario will let civilians leave, then I think what you're talking about presents a lot of, you know, reasonable ideas for serious consideration. If they will not let them leave, then essentially putting the supplies outside is not alleviating the harm to civilians, right? And the risk of starvation, because you might be able to, you know, you might argue till you're blue in the face, they should let them leave, they should let them leave. But you also have to sort of assess things in the realities of the situation. So I think it would partly depend on the ability of civilians to move from one area to another. And I think I want to also use your question, though, to flag another point that we talked about when we were talking about evacuations, but I want to bring it up here as well, because it's particularly absent in all the discussions of siege. And that is, again, that there's two parties here. And when we talk about siege, I think the erasure of the defending party is even more complete than it is sort of in other circumstances where we already tend to talk about the attacker all the time. But there is a besieged party, right? The whole idea is you're actually besieging an area because there is your, you know, the adversary's forces are there. You're not just besieging a bunch of civilians. And so I think it's really important to highlight that the besieged party also has obligations. And those don't seem to get any play at all. And so there's a sort of flag for readers that there's a really good piece on the Articles of War blog, which also hosted at West Point. So a companion to what you guys have at Modern War Institute. And it's looking at the obligations under the law of war of the besieged party. And I think it's worth a read. It's in its entirety, just to kind of really dive into it. But I just want to flag a few of the things. Keep in mind that in a siege scenario, the defending party, the one in that area or that we call the besieged party, they're actually in control of the locality, right? The attacker is outside. They've encircled, they've isolated, they've besieged it, but they're not inside the city, the urban area, and so on. And so the defender is actually in control, and they have a number of obligations under the law of war. These are, again, subject to what's feasible. And some of them relate to the passive precautions that we talked about. So I just want to flag a couple of them because they're really relevant to this conversation that we're having about how do these different things play out in a siege scenario. So again, this is based on what's feasible, but the besieged party or the defender has an obligation to move military objectives and military personnel away from civilians and civilian objects, and to refrain from conducting military operations near civilians and civilian objects. Obviously, that protects civilians. They may have an obligation to create safety or other zones that wounded and sick and civilians can be moved to enhance their protection. And that may be done through an agreement with the besieging party. They have an obligation to evacuate wounded and sick civilians, as long as in evacuating them, you're actually making it likely that they can get medical care and improve their medical situation. They have an obligation to evacuate the civilian population if its safety or health is at risk, as long as the area to which they would evacuate them is going to be better. They have an obligation to allow humanitarian relief as necessary to ensure civilians have access to supplies. And they also have an obligation to mark certain buildings and locations like hospitals and religious buildings and objects to enhance their protections in the face of attacks by the besieging party. And this last one really is quite interesting. It goes all the way back to the Hague Convention of 1907, which says you actually have to mark these, you know, sort of protected objects and tell the besieging party that you've marked them so that they're protected. So these are, you know, this is a lot. It's not just the ones laying the siege. It's the defending party as well that really has quite a lot of ability and obligation, again, within that realm of feasibility, to try to mitigate the consequences for civilians of this kind of operation.
Absolutely. I'll actually put it in the show notes and on the page for the podcast. I love the Articles of Wars. Articles. It is what it is. And we were started first, but it's a great research center and platform of publication. So many good articles there. Okay. But you just made me think of another question that I think is, but I know context matters so much. Cause we know that both sides have an obligation. And even if, like we talked about evacuation, if civilians don't evacuate, it's still an obligation to take precaution and all of these civilian harm mitigation measures that we've talked about in the last two episodes. But like this, bringing aid in, if a civilian presence in a evacuated area under all the reasonable, feasible time, routes, and everything is in an area that is a active military operation, it really gets to the question that has come about in modern times of the evacuations have been conducted. The besieged defender is not trapping the civilians, but civilians make a decision to stay. And that doesn't absolve either side of the obligations to protect and take the precautions. But does that, if you're the isolator, does that still require you to send humanitarian aid into those civilians? Because then it gets to, well, who says that they made that choice versus the people keeping them there? But in accordance with this, also this hypothetical of putting the supplies outside, I've heard people discuss, well, if they won't evacuate the civilian population, can we not send supplies in, but put the supplies in the safe area that we want them to go to and communicate to them that that's where the supplies are? Or is it still an obligation? And I know the context matters so much that it's almost hard to do these hypotheticals. Obligation to allow and bring aid into that area, which has already been evacuated. And now you're trying to further encourage by placing the supplies in the area you want them to move to.
So a couple of things. I think one thing is the obligation with respect to humanitarian relief is to allow and facilitate the rapid and unimpeded passage of humanitarian relief. So you don't have to provide it yourself. You don't have to bring it in yourself. You have to allow and facilitate. And then we get to the ability to put these technical arrangements. You cannot withhold, again, or block this access for arbitrary reasons, but you can, for example, you know, not consent if, again, it's all being diverted to the other side's military, for example. So that's one thing. The other thing with respect to civilians who choose not to evacuate, I think it's probably just not feasible, again, to use that word, but to assume that civilians can, you know, evacuate and just are choosing not to, right? Let's imagine people who have mobility challenges. They're in a wheelchair, or they have a family member who needs to be cared for and can't be moved, or, you know, any number of things, or people who have mental health challenges and aren't able to make the same decision that we might expect others would make in those circumstances, right? There could be any number of reasons why. And I've seen, for example, I think it's Civic, which is another great NGO. You know, I've seen some of their discussions about, I'm not sure I could point readers to a particular report or anything, but they have often, you know, offered insights into why civilians just don't leave, even when it's dangerous. And it's, you know, overwhelmingly dangerous, and they're being asked to leave, and they're being told to leave, and they're being offered, you know, opportunities to facilitate them leaving, but they don't. So I think in that vein, I would have some discomfort with the idea of, well, if we put the supplies here, that'll get them to go, because the things that are keeping them may be stronger, whether understandable or not, than the push and pull of, oh, there's medical care there, or there's food there. So again, a lot of this is more in the practicalities or judgment arena than pure law. But ultimately, I think where the law would come down is we can't leave out of our consideration the people who don't go anywhere. And I'm not suggesting that that's what this example was designed to do, but it might have that effect, right? That people are going to stay in the area. And overall, the idea is to try to mitigate that harm as best as possible. So if there's civilians in there and they're inadequately supplied, then there's got to, you know, be some mechanism to allow stuff to go in, you know, supplies. That's probably where I would come down. It's not, you know, that may not have been a particularly legal analysis, but that's probably where I would come down.
Right. It's hard. It's really hard. And like, I agree with you. And Civic does do great work. We've actually had Civic leaders on the show for civilian harm mitigation, 2 episodes, actually. They do great work. But I agree with you that that's why that question is really hard, because intent matters. Like we said, clearly starvation as a form of warfare against civilians is prohibited by all definitions. And then what you're doing and why you're doing it really matters under all the other fundamental principles, as well as basically feasibility. I 100% agree with you. I could talk to this for a very long time, Lori. I really appreciate you coming back on the show. I'm glad we got to sieges because I think it's really important distinctions. Some of these are really hard and contextual interpretations that really all the other variables really mattered, but I really appreciate you coming on.
Well, thanks so much for having me again. Great to talk about all these hard questions.
Thanks, Lori.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Urban Warfare Project podcast. The podcast is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of their participants and do not represent the positions of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. You can subscribe to the Urban Warfare Project podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. And be sure to check out NWI's other podcasts, as well as the new articles we're publishing every day on our website. Thanks again for listening.